horse in the field. Whether coming off a bender or coming out of jail, there is a solution, that's what you're looking for. But just open up the book and read the first 164. How it works and into action, tell you how to save your life. And they even got a chapter for your boss and for your wife. Working with others, we agnostics, little story and the rest. But we are not, a gloomy lot is the part I love the best. It's in the book, it's in the big book. You will find all your answers if you simply take a look. If you want to quit your drinking, son, come along with us. Read that big book, Alcoholics Anonymous.
Greetings, everyone. Let's have an AA meeting. My name's Tim, and I'm an alcoholic. Welcome to the Monday Night Blue Chip Speakers Meeting at the NABA Club, where a member of Alcoholics Anonymous with 1 year or more of sobriety tells his or her story.
Hey, everybody. My name is Mike Boatwright, and I'm a grateful recovering alcoholic. I had no idea I was going to do this tonight, but this reading is based on a passage from page 29 of the Big Book of Alcoholics Anonymous. Each individual in our personal stories describes in their own language and from their own point of view the way they establish their relationship with God. These give a fair cross-section of our membership and clear-cut idea of what has happened in their lives. We hope that no one will consider these self-revealing accounts in bad taste. Our hope is that many alcoholic men and women in our room tonight and listening later on aabluechipspeakers.org, desperately in need, will hear our speaker. And we believe that it is only by fully disclosing ourselves and our problems that any of us shall be persuaded to say, yes, I am one of them too. I must have this thing. I've known our speaker now for well over 20 years. He's been my sponsor for a big portion of that. I was just reflecting that between the two of us, we've buried four sponsors. We've buried a handful of sponsees. We got another one. One of my brother's sponsees passed away today, and I'm really, really deeply saddened by that. He was an active member at the Lanaman's Workshop. I told Bill that I needed God with skin on tonight, so I came showing up just to hang out with my sponsor, and I found a room full of people just like me. I could tell his story, but I'm not gonna, because it's always new, it always changes. And without further ado, I'd like to introduce you to my best friend, Bill S.
I'm relieved he didn't tell everything he knows. My name is Bill Sanders, and I'm an alcoholic. By the grace of God, I'm sober tonight, and that's the single most important thing that I can share with you from this podium. But it is by the grace of a loving God and the tender loving care of people like you in rooms like this that I have not had a drink since July 26, 1982. And I can assure you that that impresses me a heck of a lot more than it does you. I want to dedicate my talk tonight to a good friend and comrade in this fellowship who fought a valiant fight against cancer but succumbed to it this morning. His name is Preston Upshaw. He was the voice of the Atlanta Men's Workshop and been an active part of this fellowship for many years. Preston was, by the measurement of my second sponsor, Dr. Paul, who said, when he was asked the question, what is your definition of a successful alcoholic? He said, he who dies sober. And Preston died sober in this fellowship. I love him and I will miss him. I went to my first AA meeting about 4 years before I joined this fellowship. A friend of mine who was a member of AA invited me to go to a meeting with him. And I wanted to be supportive of my friend, so I went with him. I found out he had other motives for wanting me to go, but I didn't get it at that point. And he, of course, had to explain to me the things that were taking place. They read all of that stuff at the beginning of the meeting. I didn't understand any of that. And then they opened it up and people started talking and yapping and going back and forth from each other. And they were all telling things that I didn't think I'd have told if I'd have been them. And then they got to the end of the meeting, or near the end, and they called this woman up to the front of the room, and everybody started whooping and hollering and clapping. And I said, "What's going on here?" He said, "Oh, this is a little celebration. This is Mary's 24th birthday." She looked a lot older than that to me. But this guy said a bunch of stuff about her, and then he gave her something, and I said, what did he just give her? He said, that's a poker chip. I said, okay. Then they brought out this little cake, and she blew out a candle, and they all sang. And then my friend turned to me and said, "Bill, if you won't drink for a year, we'll do this for you." I said, "Now let me get this straight. If I don't drink for a year, you'll give me a poker chip and a little cake." And he nodded. I couldn't wait to get the hell out of there. And sadly, I did leave and did not come back for approximately 4 more years. My story is very much like many other people in the Fellowship of Alcoholics Anonymous. A lot of my drinking and the results of my drinking was perhaps in a lot of ways more public than many people. I spent, until I retired some years ago, I spent 50 years in radio and television. And a lot of people did not know that they heard, and in some cases saw me delivering the news, crocked to the gills. It is a miracle that I was never fired. I came very, very close. And on one occasion, while I was working in a radio station, a small town radio station in my early life, on Sunday afternoon, or rather Saturday afternoon, I was in the radio station alone. I was the only one there doing my DJ show. And I decided I needed a drink. So I put on an LP to play, and I left the station and went down the road about a quarter of a mile, and there was a little station down there that sold beer. And I got a couple of beers and came back ready to go back in and resume my radio show. Unfortunately, I had pulled the door to and locked myself out. So I had to go. I didn't have a cell phone back then. They were unheard of. And so I had to go next door to someone's house and bang on the door, get them to let me in, and call the station manager and tell him that I had locked myself out and that he better come. And as he pulled up to the station, he was listening to my broadcast going ka-chunk, ka-chunk, ka-chunk as the album ran out. It's only by the grace of God that I did not get fired then. He couldn't find anybody else that would do the job. So lasted for another 46 or 7 years in the broadcasting business. I had a lot of wonderful experiences in my career in broadcasting. I met a lot of renowned people, drank with quite a few of them. And I also had, well, I'm going to share one experience that some of you already heard, but I was working at WSB here in Atlanta. The news director came in and told me that I had to go downtown and do an interview. And I said, well, who am I going to interview? He said, you're going to interview Lyndon Johnson. Well, I got my tape recorder and got the mobile unit and started downtown. I said, you know, I can't do this without a little fortification. So I stopped at one of my neighborhood bars, had a couple of shots. Went down to the Henry Grady Hotel, long, long gone, and walked into the hotel, got on the elevator, went up to the designated floor. I was met, of course, at the door, or the door of the elevator by the Secret Service. It was frisked, and my credentials checked, and they looked at my recorder, and then they ushered me into this suite. This giant of a man came over and grabbed me by the hand and said, come on in, son, have a seat. And I walked in, I sat down on a sofa, and he sat down on another sofa facing me, and I couldn't help but notice, but in between us was a couple of glasses and a jug of Jack Daniels. He said, before we do this thing here, let's have us a little snort. Sounded good to me. I should explain at this point that back then you did not just walk in and sit down and interview the President of the United States. Back then you had to do what was known as the pre-interview interview. And that's where you tell him what questions you're going to ask, and he tells you whether or not he'll answer them. So we went through the list of questions, and he poured my glass full, and I took three or four swallows, and every time I would get a few swallows down, he'd pick up the bottle and tilt the glass back up again. Started getting hot in that room. A few minutes later, it hit me. My God, this man is drunker than you are. Then all of a sudden he said, all right, let's do it. Turn that thing on. I turned on the tape recorder and we started the interview. And the interview went great. I had good questions. He had great answers. And I had a pearl of an interview to take back and put on the air. It all went great until I got to one question. I asked him a question about his wife, Ladybug. Now, this is where older people know, younger people don't. Lyndon Johnson's wife's name was Lady Bird, not Lady Bug. Thank God he thought it was funnier than y'all did. Lots of experiences in the latter years of my time in the profession. I had to do a lot of traveling. And I used to say I was afraid of flying. I've since learned that I really never was afraid of flying. I was crashing. And so I would always get to the airport early and have a few drinks at the bar before I got on the plane. It worked. It worked real well. Except when I would forget to get on the plane. It's ironic because back then our hometown airlines, Delta Airlines, had an advertising slogan that some of you may remember. The slogan was, Delta is ready when you are. Now the irony of it is, I did the voiceover for those commercials on radio and television up and down the east coast of the U.S. I had one line in the entire commercial. And that was the last line, which says, Delta is ready when you are. Uh-uh. They'll leave you. So I'd get on another plane, go somewhere else. Call home that night. How's your meeting in New York going? I don't know. I'm not in New York. Where are you? I'm in New Orleans. And that happened more than once. And more my behavior became more and more bizarre. My relationship with my wife and my daughter corroded, and I did not know it, but at the time when I came into the Fellowship of Alcoholics Anonymous, my wife had already been talking to an attorney and finalizing divorce papers, which I was going to be served very shortly. My behavior as an alcoholic was typical, I think, of most of us. Alcohol had been my best friend for many years until it became my worst enemy. I've talked to thousands of alcoholics through the years and asked the question, at what point in your drinking career did you become aware that you had to drink, that you could not control your drinking? Nobody has ever been able to tell me when that happened in their lives. Our disease is sneaky. And somewhere along the way, quietly, it whispers into our ear, "Gotcha." And from that time on, it was downhill. A loneliness that I had felt as a kid came back quadruple fold. I could be in a crowd of people and feel alone and isolated and lost. The feeling of not belonging, of not fitting in, came back again. The same feeling that I'd had as a kid. And the pain became worse and worse and worse. And I thought that nobody knew how I felt. Because, you see, when I first started drinking, I thought that alcohol affected everybody who drank the same way that it affected me. I know now that it doesn't. That somewhat answers the questions of people who used to make really stupid remarks. Like the person at a cocktail party who would say, "No more for me, one's my limit." That's dumb. But the worst one that I never understood and I never will understand is the person who says, "No more for me, I'm beginning to feel it." I'd look at him and say, "That ain't where you quit. That's where you get going good." Never understood those people. Never did, never will. And what's more, I know they will never understand me. And I have long since quit trying to explain the disease of alcoholism to someone who hasn't experienced it or lived it. It's impossible. I am a great believer in sponsorship. I came into this fellowship, as I said, July 26, 1982. In a few days, that'll be 34 years, which still is mind-boggling to me. I did not plan to stay that long. But I'm kind of hooked on this fellowship now. My first sponsor was a man by the name of Doc Crandall. I selected him as a sponsor because he was a sweet, kind-looking, gray-haired old man, roly-poly with a great big smile all on his face all the time. And I asked him to be my sponsor. Biggest mistake I ever made in my life. I knew I was in trouble the first night that when he agreed, "Sure, I'll be your sponsor. Now, let's discuss the rules." "Rules? What rules?" He said, "It's simple. Every morning when you wake up, you're going to roll out of that bed onto your knees and you're going to ask God to keep you sober today. And the last thing you're going to do at night before you get back in the bed is get on your knees again and you're going to say thank you." And I told him, I said, "Well, now, Doc, I grew up in the Southern Baptist Church. I got a long way away from it. But I know prayer is important. God knows y'all open and close every meeting with a prayer. But I just have to be real honest with you, Doc. I'm not really comfortable with this knee business." He said, "Son, I don't remember saying a damn thing about you being comfortable." I drew myself up. He couldn't talk to me like that. I had almost 30 days. I said, "I thought this was a program of suggestion." He says, "It is. I suggest you do it or get you another sponsor." And that's how we began our relationship. Then he gave me this book. He was a nut about this book. I came to learn. He said, I want you to take this book home with you, and I want you to spend the next 3 weeks studying, not reading, studying the first 164 pages. And when you get through doing that, I want you to come back here, and we're going to sit down and talk about how you can make those principles in chapter 5 work in your life. I said, I can do that. Stopped at the office supply place on the way home, and I got me some sharp pencils, and I got me a couple of legal pads. I went home, cleared off my desk, opened that book up, and spread out my material, and went to work. And I studied, and I highlighted, and I underlined. I made notes in the margins. I jotted down the steps that didn't apply to me, and I struck through them. And then about 2.5 weeks later, I called Doc and said, I'm ready to talk. He said, hot dog, come on over. I went over to his house, and he reared back in his big old recliner chair, and I spread all my stuff out on his coffee table. He said, all right, boy, lay it on me. And I opened up the book to chapter 5, and I pointed down to that first step, and I said, now, looking at this first step here, now, as I interpret, and that's as far as I got, boy, that step don't need your interpreting. It needs your doing. I said, I know. But what I think it means is, he said, son, it's in English. It says exactly what it means. And he said, if you look closely, you'll notice they put numbers by those steps so that smart college boys like you can follow along with the rest of us. God, he was tough. And he was a fanatic about the book, I'll tell you that. One day I had a personnel problem in my office at work. I had an employee that I was having a lot of trouble with. And I went to the meeting and I said, Doc, can I talk to you a little bit before the meeting? And we got a cup of coffee and went out under a tree up at 8111 and sat down and I said, I've got a situation in my office I'm going to need your experience on. Let me lay out the situation. He said, hold it. I said, what? He said, first of all, tell me, what step are you using on this? I said, oh, Doc, you don't understand. This ain't got nothing to do with the steps. This is a real life thing here. He said, go look again. I went home, opened the book, went down through the steps. Wasn't anything in them steps about a personnel problem. Went back the next night and I said, Doc, look, I looked in there and there wasn't anything about it. So here's my situation. He said, go look again. Well, it was either the third or fourth night. I was on my way home thinking, oh my God, how did you get hooked up with this crazy old bastard? And I went home and I got the book out again and I turned to the steps and I went down through the steps and I said, and suddenly there it was. There was the answer. And over and over and over again, he sent me back to that book and back to those steps until one day the light went on in this thick skull of mine that there is nothing, nothing that is going to happen in the life of this alcoholic that the answer is in that book and in those steps. Some years ago, we came out with the fourth edition of the Big Book. Everybody thought it was a big deal. I didn't. The reason I didn't think it was a big deal because at the time when that came out, I was reading the 26th edition of the Big Book. Let me explain. I had read the Big Book from cover to cover 26 times. And every time I read it, they had rewritten that sucker. There was stuff in there that was not there the last time I read it. I told you I'm a highlighter and an underliner. And I'd look at something, I don't know why I highlighted that, that's no big deal, but this is brand new. I was sharing at an AA conference in Northern California some years ago, and after the talk, this little girl came up to me and said, do you really believe that? I said, sweetheart, I'll tell you what I believe. I believe that God speaks to me through this book. I believe he reveals to me what I need to see when I need to see it. Which means that I need to read that book on a regular basis. I'm a member of a group here in Atlanta that suggests that the members of that group read 2 pages out of the big book at least 2 pages every day. And I try to do that, and usually a little more than that. And I keep finding new things in the book. I also believe that God speaks to me through you people. I quite often say I pray for God's will and then go to a meeting to find out what it is. Because if I listen, invariably, I'll hear what I need to hear in almost every meeting I go to. And it never comes from whom I think it will come from. You know, I think what I would need to hear would come from a PhD. Usually it doesn't. So often I hear exactly what I need to hear from a young person like Preston here, who will say exactly what this old brain needs to hear. So I listen. As I said, I'm a great believer in sponsorship. In the last 33, almost 34 years, I have buried 4 sponsors. My first sponsor was Doc Crandall. He died in 1985, very tragically. He was followed by a man by the name of Hoyt Allison, who once was president of this club here and was an integral part of the Napa family and this fellowship. After him, I was sponsored by a man by the name of Dr. Paul Olliger. You may not recognize the name, but if your sponsor ever sent you to page 448 or 449, or I think in the current big book it's what, 417, is it? 417. He's the one who wrote those words. Acceptance is the answer to all my problems today. And in the 10 years that he was my sponsor before he died in 2000, he taught me about acceptance. But acceptance didn't mean liking. It meant simply that, accepting things as they are at this moment. Not necessarily that's how they're going to be tomorrow or the next day or the next year, but to accept life as it is. Over and over I would say to him, mistakenly, "Paul, I know everything's going to be okay." He said, "Bill, you don't get it. Things are okay. They're just the way they're supposed to be right now." And I believe that today, although I have to be reminded from time to time. When he died in the year 2000, I asked a man by the name of Dick Martin from Bellevue, Nebraska, to be my sponsor. And he was my sponsor until last summer when he died of Parkinson's disease. And I learned so much from Dick. He was a hard-nosed sponsor. And last year when he died, I decided to get his sponsor to sponsor me. I had thought long and hard about doing that because I knew what I was getting into when I asked a man by the name of Clancy Emsland to be my sponsor. Any of you in this room who've ever met Clancy, I don't need to explain what I just said to you. He's a hard-ass sponsor is what he is. Clancy has 56 years in this fellowship. In a couple of days, he will be 90 years old. He still travels for AA gatherings all over the world. Week before last, he was in Australia for a week and made about 10 or 15 talks over there in one week. And I have to call him every Wednesday between 2 and 3 p.m. If I call at 3:05, I'm going to get reamed out. If I forget to send him an email on Sunday of every week outlining how my week went, I'm going to catch hell for it. So this little iPhone thing I carry around has alarms built in there to it to remind me. And I learned from him because he has taught me that I have a disease of perception. I see the world differently than so-called normal people do. I don't know what normal is, but all I know is I told somebody one time if I could drink normally, I'd do it all the time. But I I came into this fellowship at the same age that Bill Wilson was when he got sober. I was 39 years old. I'm an old man now. I'm 73. Believe it or not, that's the oldest I've ever been. I know that I still enjoy working with young people coming into this fellowship. They're the lifeblood. They're the ones who will carry the torch through the rest of this century. I learn from them, and they keep me anchored in this fellowship, because every time I work with a newcomer or a young person, they take me right back through those steps again, and they refresh what I need to know. I had a young man come to me when he was 17 years old. He was an outcast. I had both of his grandmothers tell me, "Don't waste your time on him. He's the black sheep of the family. He'll never amount to anything." Dunwoody High School principal said, told him, "Never darken the doors of that school again," when he kicked him out. A juvenile court judge said, "I believe he's a derelict that will not ever amount to anything." And he comes and asks me to be his sponsor. Three times he asked me. On the third time, I gave in and said yes. And that young man embraced the fellowship of Alcoholics Anonymous. He jumped into the middle of the bed. I told him, as my sponsor told me, "Get in the middle of the bed and stay there. Nobody ever fell out of the middle of a bed." And he did. And he worked those steps. He lived those steps. And October 10th of this year, I will give a young man by the name of Scott Pass his 30-year chip. He ended up being, when one of his grandmothers died, the executor of her estate. God had worked another miracle. And you see, I know that I am a miracle. I told you at the beginning, it's by God's grace that I'm sober tonight, and that I'm able to share with you. I love being a miracle, but I also love participating in other people's miracles. I love being a little messenger boy to young men like Scott and to all the other men that I've been fortunate enough to sponsor through the years. It's a gift. And if you have some time in this program, not a lot, if you have some time in sobriety and you're not sponsoring somebody, you're cheating yourself and another person at the same time. Raise your hand when they ask anybody willing to sponsor somebody. And if you see somebody that's new and looks lost, go up and say, "Have you got a sponsor?" If they say no, say, "What do you do now?" And you get their number, and you hook up, and you begin the journey again. I remember as my first sponsor took me through the steps, rapid fire. We were going like lightning. I thought, we're going to be through here before you know it. And I asked the question that he loved the most. I said, "Doc, what do you do when you get through working the steps?" He said, "Son, you lay real still because you're dead." I want to work those steps until I'm dead. Most of my sobriety is behind me. I'm in the twilight of this fellowship, but I'm going to live every minute of it to the best of my ability. Some people today identify themselves as recovered alcoholics, and I'm okay with that. I understand what they're saying. I have recovered from a hopeless state of mind and body, but I identify myself, as Mike did when he introduced me, as a recovering alcoholic. Because you see, I'm still a work in progress. And I want to remain a work in progress until the last breath I take on this earth. If I think I have arrived, if I think I've got it, I'm in trouble. Somebody introduced me one time by saying, "Bill's an expert on the big book." I jumped all over him. I said, I am not an expert on this book. I'm a student of this book, and I want to stay a student of this book forever, as long as I live, because it keeps teaching me. We were told in step 11 to ask God's will for our lives. And I do that every morning in my morning prayers. I have to be perfectly honest with you, I no longer get down on my knees in the mornings when I pray. I can get down there okay. At my age and with my bad knees, it's getting up is another deal. So I made a little deal with God. I would sit on the side of the bed and bow my head, and we would talk every morning, and he's okay with that, and so am I. I used to get up, say those prayers. I would say several of the prayers from our book. I would recite the Lord's Prayer to myself and the Serenity Prayer. I would pray for some people that I knew and hold them up to God and ask that he bless them and take care of them. And then I would get up and I would launch off into my day. And I realized after a number of years in this fellowship that what I was doing was getting up off my knees and saying, okay, God, I'll see you back here tonight. Have a good one. And launching off and doing it my way all day. And until an old man by the name of Bill Hollingsworth told me one time, son, you need to learn how to practice the presence of God. And I said, what does that mean? He said, when you get up off your knees and you launch into your day, you say, come on, God, let's go. And I find that today when I do that, when I'm practicing all day long as though God is right here looking over my shoulder, my day goes so much better. I also, when I'm driving along in my car, a lot of times when I'm driving alone in my car, I talk with God out loud. Now, the days before cell phones, people would just think you're crazy if you drive along talking to yourself. Now they just assume I'm on the phone with somebody. I don't care. I've even gotten to the point where when that guy cuts me off on 400, I wave at him with one hand instead of one finger. And I smile. And I've learned to, for the most part, control my temper. That was the greatest character defect that I had. Have I conquered it? No, but I'm still a work in progress on that too. But I have made progress. I practice the presence of God in everything I do in life today. Before I retired, before I go into a business meeting, I used to say, God, help me close this deal and make my big pot of money on it. Once I learned to practice the presence of God, I would say, God, go with me and help me to do my best, and I'll leave the results to you. When I go to talk to a sponsee or a newcomer or someone in the fellowship, I ask God to go with me, to have me say what he would have me say. And I can honestly tell you, I've experienced sharing with somebody, and then when it was over, saying to myself, where did that come from? I said things that I didn't know to say, and I have only one thing that I can attribute it to, and that's the God I'm carrying with me, hopefully every step of the way that I go through every day. When I feel anger coming on, I say, God, please take this away from me. And 30 or 40 minutes later, it occurs to me, it's gone. I'm not angry anymore. We're a part of something very big. My first sponsor used to say that to me, and I said, yeah, I know that. There are over 2 million people. He said, no. That's not what I'm talking about. We're a part of something very, very big. You see, I believe that on May 11th, 1935, or if you prefer, when Bill got sober in December of 34, that God in his infinite and compassionate wisdom looked down and said, the lowly alcoholic has suffered for long enough. He's been the outcast of society for long enough. I've got to give him a way out. And what a way he gave us. You know, he could have said, take those alcoholics and put them in a colony like lepers so they can't contaminate the world around them. He could have said, lock them up in jails and throw away the key. Or put them in insane asylums, as many of us were headed. But he didn't do any of that. Instead, he gave us each other. And he gave us more love and more laughter and more joy and more happiness than we could have ever dreamed of in 100 lifetimes. And you'll never convince this alcoholic that he didn't do one more thing. I believe he gave us a one-on-one relationship with him that few people on this earth will ever know. He gave us a brotherhood and a sisterhood where we help each other. We just experienced a tragic, tragic week in our nation. Lives have been lost. I watched for several hours the other night as young people walked the streets of Atlanta protesting. And every time I see that or that kind of thing happening, I say, if only we could give them what we have. And the brotherhood and sisterhood of the Fellowship of Alcoholics Anonymous, this world would be a better place. And the only thing that we can do is to share what we found in this fellowship with those who are like us and even those who are not. Because wherever you go and whatever you do, I've come to realize we are walking copies of the Big Book. And we may be the only copy of the Big Book that somebody ever sees. As I said, I've buried four sponsors. And all five men that have sponsored me were very different in a lot of ways. But they had one thing in common. They didn't tell me what to do. They showed me what to do. Because, see, I can see what you do a lot clearer than I can hear what you say. I try to be the best copy of the Big Book that I can be for those that I come in contact with. And there's a prayer that I still pray virtually every day before I go to bed at night. It's a very simple little prayer. It goes, thank you, God, because I almost missed all of this. Thank you for listening, and God bless.
Thank you, Bill. Thanks for coming back. This is the third time you've spoken since I got sober here at this meeting.
So much,
yeah. Yes. Yeah. And it just keeps getting better and better. We truly appreciate it.
Hey, where have we seen a person fail? Whether coming off a bender or coming out of jail, there is a solution, that's what you're looking for. But just open up the book and read the first 164. How it works and into action, tell you how to save your life. And they even got a chapter for your boss and for your wife. Working with others, we agnostics, little story and the rest. But we are not, a gloomy lot is the part I love the best. It's in the book, it's in the Big Book. You will find all your answers if you simply take a look. If you want to quit your drinking, son, come along with us. Read that big book, Alcoholics Anonymous. In a small roadside cafe, said Jim, I think some whiskey in my milk might be okay. Well, it didn't do no damage, so he owed it several more up. And the next time they seen Jimmy, he was tore up from the floor up. It's in the book, it's in the big book. You can find our simple program. You can take the step we took. When you're skeptical and doubtful, there is one thing you can trust. It's the big book, Alcoholics Anonymous. Some say it's poorly written and the language is archaic, but it's steady saving lives around the world for goodness sake. It can help a PhD and those unscarred by education if you don't have contempt prior to investigation. That's from the book. It's in the big book. Son, get one of your own. Take it home and take a look. It costs less than $7, but it's worth $1 million. It's the big book, Alcoholics Anonymous. Hell, we'll give it to you. The big book, Alcoholics Anonymous.